Despite the winter cold covering North America, the year 2014 was probably the hottest ever recorded. It's another milestone in the road to extreme climate change. But maybe you've noticed the resistance. Friends, family, or workmates don't want to talk about it. You know the science and the truth about warming, and you're stuck with it. Are we alone with this awful knowledge? Back in 2013, we heard from Rosemary, or Ro Randall. She's the UK psychotherapist that co-founded Carbon Conversations. That's the place where circles of people meet to talk about climate change. It's time to connect again. Ro Randall, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I'm pleased to be with you, Alex.
Always great to talk with you. So why don't we remind listeners how Carbon Conversations work? Can you give us an outline of the program?
Carbon Conversations consists of small groups of 6 to 8 people who meet around 6 times over a period of about 3 months to talk about climate change and carbon reduction. They meet with 2 trained facilitators and they use some specially prepared materials which take people through all the different elements of how, as individuals, we have an impact on the climate and what we can do about changing that. And the groups provide a safe place. I think this is very important. It's a place where people can feel free to speak without fear that they're going to be judged and without fear that they're going to be pressured into doing something which they maybe don't feel able to manage. So one of the things which characterizes our relationship to climate change is that it is in the long term going to require us to make big changes in how we live our lives, and that people very often react to that with very complex mixes of feelings. It makes people feel anxious, ashamed, guilty, angry, uncertain, despairing sometimes. And so it's very important that when people begin to try to understand what it is that's going on, what has gone on and what has to happen next, that they're able to do so in a place where they can work out what they feel about this, they can work out what their own views on it are, what their ideas are, and with the support of others, come to some decisions that feel right to them. And, of course, people also need quite a bit of information in order to be able to do that. I was having a conversation just the other day with a really lovely young woman. She'd just flown in from the States, in fact, and she was telling me about how she discovered that by using a particular font when you typed, you could use a lot less ink, and this was going to be a really good thing for climate change. And this was a very sweet statement, but, of course, any savings that she might make by using a different font would be dwarfed by the flight that she'd just taken. And very often people don't understand how important certain things are and how small perhaps other things are in this big picture. So finding ways to give people reliable information is also really, really important.
So now, almost a couple of years since we last talked, what's new?
Well, what's new is that we have taken a really good look at everything we've been doing. We've absorbed a lot of feedback from people about the way that we have presented the materials and the way that we run the groups. And we've come up with a brand new book, which is called In Time for Tomorrow, the Carbon Conversations Handbook, a new workbook, some new online materials, a new guide to facilitating the groups. And we're about to launch that in January this year, January the 14th. And the big difference is that whereas before, in order to get your hands on any of these materials, you had to sign up and join a group. The book, In Time for Tomorrow, is now available to the public. You can buy it by going to the Carbon Conversations website. And we're hoping that by reading the book, more people are going to feel drawn into taking part. And we've also put a lot of new material into the book. One of the things which people told us was that they wished there was more in the book about the psychological dilemmas that people go through when they're in the groups. Because originally we thought, well, that's experiential stuff. As a psychotherapist, I often feel that telling people stuff doesn't really change very much. You've got to experience it. And so we haven't put in a lot of detail about the anxiety, the guilt, the sense of loss, the way people get stuck when they try to reduce their footprint. And this time around we have. We've put a lot more new material in on that. We've also created a whole new chapter which is called talking with friends, family, and colleagues. And this is about the point which you raised in your introduction, which is about what do you do if you yourself are concerned, but when you start to raise it at the dinner table with friends or somebody's chatting around the water cooler at work, you meet a kind of wall of indifference, and you can find yourself seen as the oddball, the odd one out, the one who's always making everybody else feel bad. And so this time around, we're trying to deal head on with some of those experiences as well.
Yeah, it really isn't easy. You bring up climate change and a friendly conversation can drop with a dull thud, and that leaves us feeling exposed. How do we handle that?
I think one thing is to start to think strategically about when you want to talk about climate change and when you don't. So that when the conversation at work is just around, oh, I flew here, I flew there, I've bought a new car, I've bought this new staff, these may be times to stay quiet. And unless you're sure that you can bring in your own point of view without being seen as attacking somebody else. And often it's better to look for your own opportunities and to think about, well, who do I actually want to talk to about this? And in what kind of context do I want to raise this? So if it's a situation at work, for instance, you might actually want to start opening up a conversation at work about sustainability in the workplace. You might want to create a special forum where that is discussed amongst work colleagues. So it becomes the main thing on the agenda. And you're sure, in a way, I think then, that people are going to be looking at it in terms of what they can do. They're not instantly going to be feeling criticized. And another example might be with your family. If your favorite uncle has just announced that he's going to fly the entire family to Goa to celebrate his 60th birthday, if you say, I don't think I'm going to go because I've stopped flying, it's not going to go down very well. So you need to create the situation where you start to talk about your own decisions. So you might decide to say to somebody who you feel closest to in the family, I just want to talk about some of the things that have been interesting me, troubling me recently, because I've taken some quite big decisions about how I'm changing my life. So you introduce it as a personal subject, personal to you. And I think when you do that, you're more likely to get a positive response, because people will be interested in the fact that it's you doing it, that you're not telling them what they should do at this point. So that's certainly a part of it, I think, is choosing your moments, choosing your opportunities, trying to create the opportunities that you want.
Right. I think that's really important to be able to say, well, this is what I'm feeling about this, and this is what I'm doing about it, without saying, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that.
I think that's really essential. I think the moment that you start to use those words should, shouldn't, ought, oughtn't, you've set yourself up as a moral authority, and you become a persecutor to other people. You remind them of everybody else in their life who ever said, you shouldn't do that. Every teacher, every parent, every boss who told you what to do, you're suddenly in those shoes. And so you create what we might call a parent-child conversation, where you're the authoritarian parent and they're the child. And sometimes people will also put you into that position. They will take on the role of the rebellious teenager, and they will put you in that position, even if you've not been trying to take it up. And so I think being able to spot these sorts of dynamics in conversations can be very, very important. Trying to get into that adult conversation where you say what you think, they say what they think, you listen to each other. And that's another very important word, as I'm sure I've said to you before, Alex, is listen. You know, that when we listen to other people, we start to understand their life, their dilemma, why they're doing the things they do. We stop seeing them as a caricature and as a bad person. You know, you start to understand that your uncle who wants to take the whole family to Goa is doing this because he loves you all, because he'd really like to go there, because it's been his dream since he was, however old, and so on. And you start to have a conversation that's a real conversation between two people and not a conversation between what I refer to as the projections, what the things we imagine about other people, which aren't necessarily true.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're having a carbon conversation of sorts right now with Ro Randall, the English psychotherapist, contributing her skills to the challenge of climate change. And Ro, it seems like the more we know about the climate problem, we're almost split in two. We worry about the future, and at the same time, we're maybe hoping to buy a new car or, as you say, planning air travel to meet up with family. Is it possible to be kind of a whole person even while this dichotomy, while the fossil fuel civilization rules?
I think one of the really important things to understand is that we're all creatures of conflict. We're made up of competing desires and impulses. I think you're spot on with what you said just then. You know, one part of myself, I really feel that I should be doing everything I can to make sure that dangerous climate change doesn't develop. With another part of myself, I want to do all the things that feel just ordinary in this society. I want to leave the lights blazing in my house. I want to turn the heating up. I want to buy some new clothes. I want to do those home renovations. I'd like a big new car. I'd like to fly and see my relatives in the States. All of these things are also going on. And I'm drawn into social and political systems which make those things easy. So it's not surprising, I think, that people find themselves full of conflicts about what their values are, what they feel they should be doing, what they want to do, and full of conflicts because maybe they're doing stuff, but other people aren't. And so I think to recognize that we are all full of conflict, and that's a normal situation. We can't all be kind of 100% consistent the whole time. We would be robots if we were consistent like that. So we're negotiating conflict the whole time and facing difficult emotions around everything that we do.
Well, as Kermit the Frog says, it's not easy being green. So during the holiday season, I spent time talking with a geoscientist about our prospects. He was really pleased to talk with someone about climate change because scientists can feel shut in by what they know due to the things we've just been talking about. So, Ro Randall, do climate scientists need support as well?
I think they do. Over the last year, I've spent quite a bit of time talking with climate scientists about their experience of holding this very, very difficult knowledge. And in some ways, I think being part of a scientific community supports those people because you can bury yourself in your latest bit of research. You can retreat into the rationality that characterizes science. So there are kind of structural ways that people can protect themselves. But I think when it actually comes down to it, if you're a climate scientist, you're working with very, very frightening knowledge, and you're working in a situation where you know that most people in politics are not listening hard enough and are not actually taking the actions that need to be done. So I think that for people, anybody working in those situations, some kind of availability of support and conversation for how this makes you feel is very important. So I think if that doesn't happen, you get people burning out, and that really isn't something we want to see at the moment.
Right. Do you think telling people about the awful possibilities of climate change can actually hurt some sensitive people? Can we communicate the urgency and seriousness of our situation without making someone's mental health worse?
Some of the research into this is quite interesting because what it shows is that when you shock people with terrible images and frightening tales, you get an immediate reaction of, my God, this is dreadful, I must do something, but it doesn't last. And I think that this is because what happens is that when you shock somebody like that, you create a situation where it's essential that they put back their defenses because we can't tolerate that level of anxiety for very long. And so people start to reconstruct a world where they don't have to have that kind of knowledge front of mind. And I think the dilemma is that if you tell people, well, it's not so bad and there's lots of nice little easy things you can do, you don't actually get people on board to really do what is necessary. And so I think what we have to do is to create in all kinds of levels of society what I refer to as containment or safe spaces, which is the situation where it's possible to face something really difficult, but feel that things aren't going to completely fall apart if you do. So this is very much what we try to do in the Carbon Conversations groups. We're saying, yes, this is actually very, very serious, but we can face this together. There is stuff we can do. There is stuff we can do individually and collectively and politically, and we can be part of a movement that's trying to do something, and we can get strength from that. And so I think it's about how you tell people bad news, really.
Well, I have to watch that on this radio show, but sometimes you just have to say it as it is and hope that people can deal with it. Now, do you think there's a particular kind of personality who's more likely to accept the science ahead of most people around them? Why do some people get the big picture while others seem immune or closed off?
I think that's a tremendously interesting question, because I think when you look internationally at acceptance of climate change, you find a different picture in different countries. So you find higher levels of acceptance in some of the European countries like Germany and Scandinavia than you do in parts of the United States. And it's as if climate change has become associated for some people with other things which they don't like, or has become, attached to particular political agendas rather than being seen as a problem which affects all of us, whatever political solution we might want to take to it. And I think that then produces psychological reactions that some of us, I suppose all of us in a way, we're all able to hold things in different compartments in our minds. Psychologists refer to this as a process of disavowal. We know a piece of bad news with one bit of our mind, and we don't know it with another. And this lets us kind of carry on as normal. And so I think that there are all kinds of ways in which at the moment, for some people use that defensive strategy much, much, much more than others do, to try to pretend to ourselves that we're not really involved. And in some ways, I think the more serious form of this is not the big one, where the people who actually say, no, climate change isn't happening. It's all the rest of us who say, yeah, I know climate change is happening, but I don't really think it's anything much to do with me, or I know it's happening, but I hope the government will sort it out, or I know it's happening, but I don't think there's anything I can do. Those of us who sort of make these kind of rationalizations of why we can carry on just as we are.
Do you think in Carbon Conversation groups there are more women than men? And if so, why? And what does that mean?
There are more women than men who come to Carbon Conversation groups. This is true. I've been fascinated by this. I don't have an answer. Some of the answers that I come up with are kind of cliches. Women are more willing to talk about how they feel. And yet I know loads of men who are very happy to talk about how they feel. So I'm not convinced it's that. Some people claim that, women have a closer connection to nature. I don't really believe that. Lots of men are also gardeners and farmers and fishermen and are close to nature. So I don't know why this is. And I would love to hear other people's views about why this seems to be the case.
I sometimes wonder whether it's just the sort of solitary hunter lineage in our genes, that in many animals we see that the mother and the children stay together while the male is off somewhere and appears now and then.
So we're going back to their early tribal origins. Maybe there is something to do with the fact that men in groups often tend to be doing active things together. Men get together to play sport or to go drinking. Women get together to chat. And maybe the Carbon Conversations groups do have perhaps a slightly gendered feel to them for some men. That could be an explanation. you know, maybe there is a bit of a kind of history of the influence of feminist consciousness-raising groups in the way carbon conversation works. I'm not sure about why this is gendered.
Well, I'm looking forward to more men, you know, forming carbon conversation groups, if that's what it takes. Now, I'd like just to get to a thought experiment as we head towards the end of our time. If we move 10 years ahead, say to 2025, record hot years are the new normal. Storm surges have already hit major cities. The Arctic is being transformed. What's the next stage for thinking about climate change once it is really obvious? Where's the next mental place we need to be?
Doesn't it, into the arguments about mitigation and adaptation. And I think 10 years ago, it was very clear that all our conversations were about mitigation. They were about how we might prevent climate change or prevent the worst. And increasingly, we're seeing conversations start about adaptation. How are we going to cope with what's coming? And I think that the conversations that we need to have to be about justice and equality, because what I think we see when we look at what's likely to happen, the worst things are likely to happen to the poorest people in the most deprived areas of the world. And I think we've seen that even where, you know, disasters have hit already. You see that they're always much worse in the less prosperous areas of the world. You know, if you look at anything comparable like earthquake protection in California, it's brilliant. In Turkey, it's not great. And I think this means that we have to try and create frameworks where we think globally about justice in relation to climate change.
Do you think the next generation will blame us, or will everyone be just too busy trying to cope and adapt?
It's horrible to think that you might be blamed, isn't it? I'm 65. I look back at what my generation have done with the world, and I don't feel good about it. I feel ashamed. And yet I think that as an individual, I did what I could. So I think that's a very hard question. I think it's very important that we keep a sense of connectedness to the generations before and the generations after, and respectful connections. That we try not to blame. We try to respect what we've inherited, and we try to prepare for those who come after us. Whether the generation that comes after us are going to say, "You did okay, you did your best," or whether they're going to look and they're going to go, "You idiots! Why didn't you wake up sooner? Why didn't you act?" I don't know.
I'm going with the "you idiots" answer, but. You know, to be honest, I haven't heard a lot about carbon conversations here in North America or in Australia, where they're so desperately needed. Is it coming? Has it already started?
Well, we have a young, wonderful young woman called Kat Laird in Alberta who is starting up carbon conversations. We're hoping that she's going to get something going. And there's a great organization in Australia called Psychology for a Safe Climate. Now, they're not actually doing carbon conversations, but they're talking about psychology and climate change. And, of course, that's also where the great Clive Hamilton hails from. So there are people in Australia who are talking about it. And so in Canada, a cat, she tweets as Carbon Conversations CA, I think. Anyway, there are people talking about it, but I think one of the difficulties about something like carbon conversations is in our books, the detailed information is very UK specific, and that all needs to be translated for Canada, Australia, America, if you're going to follow the exact model we follow. But I think that getting people together in small groups to talk about the issues that we face, the way we cope with it psychologically, the way we handle our sense of loss and guilt and anxiety about this, I think anybody who gets together and does that will be doing a great job.
Where will people get this new handbook in time for tomorrow?
If you go to the Carbon Conversations website, which is www.carbonconversations.org, you will find on there information about how to buy the book. You can also go to my website, which is rorandall.org. And on that site, there's actually like a button you can press, and it will take you to a PayPal button and a price for Canada, and you can buy a copy.
I'm going to do it. Ro, thank you so much. It's always encouraging to talk with you.
Well, it's been great. It's been a great conversation, Alex. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.